Hello and welcome to The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell for The Virginia Voice, and today I have in the studio with me Anne McMillan. Anne is a Richmond author. She's written a number of mysteries that were set in the Civil War, two of which we will be programming here on The Virginia Voice. Her mysteries, Angel Trumpet and Civil Blood. Welcome to The Writer's Voice, Anne.
Thank you, Patty.
It's great to have you here. I think the first thing I want to do is get you to read something from one of the books.
Well, I will read the opening pages of Dead March, my first mystery. It's about a grave robbing, and we can talk about how I got into that, if you want to, after I read a little.
And let me just say, the four mysteries that you have written all feature the same main characters.
Yes.
They go from book to book to book, so we may encounter some of them now or not.
You may encounter some of them now, but three of the four characters in these opening pages will be dead by the end of the book.
Okay.
Because this is a murder mystery. So, Chapter 1, Richmond, Virginia, the 1st of March, 1861. A shovel struck the ground, bit deep. Then a second. The two blades set a rhythm, scooping the dirt and dumping it aside, moving in and out of the narrow beam of light thrown across the ground by a bullseye lantern. The diggers were two black men, one old, one young. They worked quickly, their faces glistening with sweat despite the cold. Soon they had hollowed a trench more than a foot deep and large enough for a man to lie down in. Two white men stood a few paces off in the darkness. "Careful now, old Billy, and you, Cyrus," came a drawl from the nearer of the two. "There's no coffin." "All right, Doc Archer," the younger man, Cyrus, called in response. He glanced at old Billy and spoke, too low for the white men to hear. "How'd he know that?" "I ain't complaining, mind you. No coffin, don't need no hooks. Might as well be digging up taters." Overhead, the stars were bright in the moonless sky. The air was cold, but not sharply so. In the almost blackness was visible a jumble of pale shapes that fenced in the scene. After a while, old Billy paused in his work and held up his hand to his companion. "Done hit something." Cyrus shook his head, wondering. "Whoever put him in ain't spent no time digging deep." Old Billy made no reply. The shovels moved more slowly now. Soon a fold of dirt-encrusted sacking was revealed. The shovels continued lifting and brushing clods away until they had uncovered an oblong shape, a little under 6 feet long, wrapped in wide bands of burlap. Through the smell of turned earth came another smell, rotten, repellent. The shovel stopped. Cyrus wrinkled his nose and spoke again. "Doc said this here stiff was fresh." "Just put in, that's what he said," old Billy corrected. "Come on, Cyrus, let's finish it up." Old Billy and Cyrus stepped back from the trench and dropped their shovels. Old Billy pushed back his sleeves, revealing scrawny arms corded with muscle. Two fingers on his left hand were missing below the knuckles. Despite his grizzled hair, he looked the stronger of the two. Cyrus fingered a string around his neck and avoided old Billy's eyes. He was strong, too, but softer, with rounded shoulders and a wispy goatee. Cyrus turned his gaze to the two white men. Cameron Archer, arms folded across his chest, leaned against a carved monument, an angel in the shape of a woman, that gleamed faintly in the darkness. He wore a cape flung across his body and a wide-brimmed slouch hat pulled low over curling dark hair that reached his collar. He was taking in the scene with eager, restless eyes that belied his nonchalant pose. The fourth member of the party, a man of about 20, stood slightly behind Archer. He had on a heavy coat, a knitted muffler around his throat. His head was bare. His brown eyes were wide but steady, his lips compressed. Archer stepped forward, motioning to the younger man. "All right, let's see the prize for our night's work. Come on, Charlie, it's not going to bite you." The workman lifted the bundle shape from the trench and placed it on the ground. They fumbled for the head and pulled away the rough sacking. Beneath it, the head was wound in a band of fine white cloth. The smell enveloped them then, a physical presence that made their throats close and their eyes water. Archer picked up the lantern and bent down to pull away the cloth. He directed the shaft of light onto the face, examined it for a few seconds, then turned away, leaving the dead in darkness once again.
A very vivid description of people basically robbing a grave. How did you get interested in writing something like this, Anne?
I knew I wanted to write a historical mystery, or to try to write one. And I'm very interested in medical history. And one of the books I read to just inform myself about medical history was the History of Medicine in Virginia by Wyndham Blanton. He has several volumes of history. And he wrote about the Sack 'em Up Boys, or resurrection men, who robbed graves to procure bodies for the Medical College of Virginia, because that was what students learned anatomy on, and there was no legal means to get the bodies, so graves had to be robbed. And in places with very outstanding medical schools, such as Edinburgh in Scotland, no grave was safe from the Sack 'em Up Boys. So, of course, the phrase Sack 'em Up Boys and the whole idea of grave robbing intrigued me. And I started to think of what ifs, which I think is what mystery writers usually do and how they come up with their plots. What if the grave was robbed and the body, the cadaver, delivered to the medical school, and it was discovered that the body had been murdered? So that was my what if, and what began the plot of Dead March.
Fascinating. I'm sorry that we're not going to be hearing that on the Virginia Voice as well, but it has not yet been recorded. You said you have always been interested in medical history. At the time you started writing this series, weren't you working at MCV?
I have worked at VCU and MCV over the years, and I don't think I was working there. It's been so long ago, but I don't think I was. But I had been intrigued. They have a little medical museum and wonderful archives, and, of course, dates back to the 1830s. So I knew where to go and who to talk to get my information.
To start doing research.
And I've always been fascinated with the Egyptian building, which was the original building of the medical school, still there, surrounded by the rest of MCV. And really a stone's throw from the White House of the Confederacy, which is very strange to think about how close close grave robbing was going on, or medical dissection, to the center of the political sphere in Richmond.
Now, when you were at MCV, you were not involved, though, in medicine per se. You, in looking at your background, have a degree in English from Agnes Scott College and are actually Dr. Anne McMillan with a PhD from Indiana University in literature and medieval studies. The transition from medieval studies to Civil War and medical history. Talk to me a little bit about what's been going on and how your interests have changed.
Yes, I'm more of a fan of medicine than I am a practitioner, certainly. I just write about it for grant proposals and publicity.
Because you were actually a fundraiser at MCV.
I did that and also public relations.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just went to graduate school because I love to read and write, and I didn't want to stop after college. Medieval studies really hasn't been something that I pursued much, but I got a book when I was in graduate school called The Horrors of the Half-Known Life, which was a medical history of essentially of gynecology, and it was horrible, based on the fact that doctors didn't wash their hands, so they would go from doing an anatomy on a cadaver to delivering a baby, so survival rates plummeted. People always did better when they didn't go to doctors at the time. So I kind of carried that idea with me, and that also is in Dead March.
The whole, yes, that, I remember that.
The whole idea of doctors not washing their hands. It's just, they're just such striking examples of things that have changed and shock us in a way, whereas a lot of things haven't changed and don't shock us.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, robbing graves is just a shocking idea.
No.
Because, you know, it just runs deep against our culture, whereas donating one's body to medical science is not a shocking idea. But see how far we've come, because nobody would have considered doing that back then. So.
And really only in 150 years, too, when you think about it.
Right.
All of the books have some medical aspect. One involves smallpox-tainted money. One involves the hallucinogenic effects of Datura poisoning. What is Datura?
Are you familiar with Jimson weed?
Okay,
that's
yes.
What it is.
Okay.
Or
okay.
Angel Trumpet is another name for it, which is why the book is named
called
Angel Trumpet.
Okay. And then malaria. So all have some sort of medical aspect. How did you decide to set these in the Civil War period?
I was very resistant to it. I wanted to write my novel set in London, like everyone else. But
now, like everyone else, the mystery writers you love, is
right.
That what you mean? Who are your favorites?
Well, starting with Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, which I read through at a young age, Agatha Christie, Anne Perry for historicals. There's just nothing like the London fog of the 1800s.
So how did we get to the War of Richmond?
Well, just because there was so much information here, and so many people to talk to, and so many places to visit, and so many experts, and ways you could walk the ground and get your hands on things. And just the Egyptian building. What a wonderful symbol that is, to have that still around. So really, just because I was becoming steeped in it, despite my objections.
Sometimes being steeped in something is the same as being overwhelmed by it, I think. How did you, and in looking at the books, I know that they are very, very carefully researched. I know you've spent a lot of time doing the research to get the details right in the books. How did you keep yourself from being overwhelmed by the information?
I can't read history that focuses on generals and battles with a very removed view, the broad sweep. I can't do the broad sweep. I have to follow a soldier or an individual person, which is exactly what I did in the first book with Britt Wallace, my British journalist. There was a British journalist, William Howard Russell, who got embroiled in a similar situation at the First Battle of Manassas, and I followed him and added some details from other people. But I like to keep it very specific, because I think things are truer when they're in one person's point of view. Even though it seems odd for a fiction writer to be talking about things being true, I think historical writers are very exacting as to what they put in print.
You have not one, but three characters that we encounter and spend a lot of time with as we read these books. The first you've mentioned, Britt Wallace, who from London, you did get a little bit of
That's
London
true.
In here. But also two fascinating characters, I think. Narcissa Powers, a white woman who's a widow, and Judah Daniel, who is a free black woman, and a free black woman who is actually the source of a fair amount of medical knowledge in these books. Tell me about how Narcissa and Judah came about.
I think Narcissa is how I imagined who I would be if I had lived at that time. Not from the upper class, educated somewhat by proxy because her husband was a well-educated man, full of feeling and kind of feeling her way through things, not so much based on research. Judah Daniel is a person, in a way. There's a wonderful history by Suzanne Lebsock called The Free Women of Petersburg. And she talks about a free black woman who gained her freedom by her doctoring skills. And this woman changed her name when she became free, as my character Judah Daniel did. But I had to make a drastic change because this historical woman was a leecher and a cupper. And even though I do discuss a lot of gory things, I really did not want to have a major character carrying around leeches.
Mm-hmm.
So I consulted an expert in slave healing who sent me a lot of information on plant medicines that were used and how she's reconstructed. Her name is Sharla Fett. How she's reconstructed how they were viewed in their communities and how they thought about themselves, which is a wonderful work of history, and gave her that access to medicine instead of carrying around leeches and drawing blood.
Now, when you say you consulted Sharla Fett, did you actually get in touch with her, or did you read her book?
I got in touch with her through a man who had arranged an exhibit at the Virginia Historical Society years ago on the history of medicine, and he said, I called him for information on slave healing, and he said, oh, well, you need to talk to Sharla Fett. So I wrote her, I suppose, and she was incredibly helpful and generous.
And now where is she?
I can't remember where she teaches now. She's
But she's not here in Richmond.
No, she's not in Richmond. I believe she is a professor in Texas, but she's very, very good at what she does.
Now, you were working full-time when you were writing these books or researching?
I started doing the research when Hunter was about 2 years old, our daughter. And since my husband worked at night, I had this time in the evening that I would read. And I realized that if I got a good book, I would stay up too late. So I thought, well, I'll see if writing instead of reading will slow me down, which it definitely did. And that's how I did it. I was working part-time and writing at night, and then a little later on, when Hunter was in preschool, I would leave her in preschool maybe an hour and write in the afternoon. Because it was kind of a hobby and a release at the time.
Can we hear some more?
Sure. I'll read about the introduction of Judah Daniel as a character, also from Dead March. Judah Daniel stood in her garden, running her hands up and down the length of sacking that served as her gardening apron. The damp earth felt good on her hands. Even the sore place between her shoulders felt good. She looked around her with pleasure. It was a perfect March day in Richmond, warm sun and cool breeze. The trees were bare of just budding. If she angled her eyes just right, she could see from her yard straight down to where the James River winked in the sun. She stood with her shoulders back, legs braced apart, head high, as if she had conquered more than the soil beneath her feet. Despite her almost 40 years, her dark brown skin was taut on her spare frame, and the eyes in her high cheekboned face were bright. Her full, curving lips, relaxed for an instant from their usual compression, gave her face its only sign of softness. She took pleasure in this garden, which extended about 20 feet across, a little more than the width of her house, and 8 feet deep. In that small space grew flowers, herbs, and shrubs of all descriptions. Not much this early to be showing new growth, but she had prepared the rich earth. Many of the plants she grew there would be called weeds and despised by gardeners, but they were among her most potent medicines, whose power had been known to the Indians. Milkweed, butterfly weed, wild geranium, tansy, angel trumpet, horse nettle. By July, their growth would be lavish, needing to be controlled rather than nurtured. Other plants and the bark of trees, dogwood, willow, she would gather down by the river. "It ain't much," she thought as she looked at the ground she tended, "but it's work I done for myself, not some master, and it's me that'll get the good of it. Me and them that I doctor." She was respected, and rightly, she thought. Depending on the healer's skill, the plant she used as medicines could cure or kill, ease pain or cause it, calm a madman's raving, or drive a sane one mad with terrible visions. Yet the women who had taught her had not been respected by the white men and women who owned them. Not respected, though they could heal, though they were close to God, who healed through them. Though their old wisdom gave them weapons they could have used to kill those who enslaved them. She followed their lead, resisting temptation to take justice into her own hands, though sometimes it was hard. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord."
In both of the readings, the distinction between white characters and African-American characters has been drawn and pointed out, which has become, I think, a very sensitive issue, or has always been a very sensitive issue, but is, I think, a sensitive issue for a modern-day writer to be dealing with. Did you have any trepidation about how you were going to deal with that in your books? In the whole Civil War fiction genre has lots of, I think, pitfalls around race issues.
I knew if I was going to write about the Civil War, I had to show all points of view, because that's the only way it would be true, and it's also the only way that it would be interesting to me. I just figured my books would never be published, so nobody would ever call me on it, which turned out not to be true, but I'm proud of it. I like having done it and having gotten out some information about the free blacks and the slaves, but mainly the free blacks in Richmond at the time.
In writing, you mentioned that it had to be interesting to you. Can a writer write about things that are not as interesting? Are there portions of the books that needed to be included that weren't as interesting to you?
There are things that I have trouble with as a writer, and maybe I could have gained some sophistication on that, and maybe I did, I'm not sure. But it was always hard for me to move characters around from one point to the other. And I felt that I had to know and say how they got from one place to another, which I really probably didn't, I realize now. And a lot of people don't go into that much detail all the time, but it was, I guess, part of my research obligation that I laid on myself was, okay, how did person move from point A to point B? And it was challenging, always.
You said you thought the books would never be published. And I'm interested in the idea of doing this much work and being this meticulous with the research on something that you think is not going to be published. How did you keep yourself going if you thought it wasn't going to be published? Did you hope?
The research was the fun part, really. Writing is much harder and just harder to find your way through, I guess. But I guess after I finished a draft, I got stubborn. And I knew it wasn't good enough, but I was going to try to make it good enough to get published. And so I had everybody I knew read the draft and give me comments, and I started submitting it to agents, which is a very humbling process. And I just used anything that I could find to help it, you know, to help me make it a better book. Because I guess after I got to a certain point, I thought, yeah, I really want this published.
Now, Dead March And all of the books have been published by Viking. But you got your contract with Dead March.
Yes.
After you got your contract, did you decide that you would follow up and make additional submissions, or did you get a contract for a series?
It was a two-book contract, the first one, which I was a bit taken aback by, because now I have to do this again in a year, whereas I had taken my time with the first one. And then for the second two books were a second contract.
You say it's different when you have to produce a book in a year, when you had taken your time beforehand. Did it take any of the joy out of the writing, or did it make the writing experience more interesting for you?
Oh, probably both, but I did have some trouble with the pressure, with all the books after the first one. I've always been a person who turned in their papers early, who never asked for an extension. But this is just a different challenge than I had ever faced, because what appealed to me about writing, and when I thought I wanted to try it, was reading a story that a friend of mine had written and realizing that every decision is your decision and things can go any way you want them to. And I realized that that would be very, very, very hard, but also very freeing. There are a few things in life that is true of.
That's true. There are a few things that you can make all the decisions on.
But it became harder when you had a deadline to, you know, to make all those decisions and make it work and get it in and wrap it up.
How valuable were other people to you?
Oh, incredibly valuable. I should definitely thank my husband first, because he is always my best and hardest editor. And I don't always act appreciative of that fact. I usually start off by grumbling, complaining, and telling him he's wrong, and then taking about 60-75% of his suggestions.
First part of that sounds like a good wife's reaction to me.
So many people all over town who are just, you know, work at the Library of Virginia or the Virginia Historical Society or the Medical College of Virginia or White House of the Confederacy, people at all those places. Reenactors helped me. National Park Service people helped me. Just people helped me. Everybody loves to share what they know about the Civil War, and so I had a lot of help.
Those sound, though, like people who were helping you with the details, with the research, with the information. How about with the writing? Different animal, I think.
That's true. I would just call on my friends to read and respond. And I didn't really have a writer's group at the time. I'm in one now, a very small one.
We'll talk more about that in just a minute. But could you read another selection for us?
Yes. It's interesting to me, just having read what I read from Dead March, talking about Judah Daniel, how much I picked up on that in the second book, Angel Trumpet. The what if for Angel Trumpet had to do with a slave rebellion based on, the idea, I guess, was based on Gabriel's rebellion in Henrico County. But
give us a little history on that, Anne.
It was a fairly major slave uprising that began with slaves in Henrico County, one of whom was Prosser's Gabriel. There have been some good research on him and that movement. And he wanted to take over the armory and kill exploitative whites, not Quakers and not Methodists, because they were anti-slavery in his book. His motto was death or liberty. And had he...
Sounds a little bit like give me liberty,
well,
or
doesn't
give
it?
Me death.
Doesn't it? I mean, he saw himself in the tradition of Patrick Henry and of America. For better or for worse, the rebellion was sidetracked. It was betrayed by a couple of people, and the weather was terrible. So the bridges washed out, and it just failed. But in Lakeside, there's a little park, which is a site of fomentation of Gabriel's rebellion. So it's very interesting. Anyway, a mystery writer can't just have a slave rebellion. It has to be a slave rebellion, but what if it isn't what it appears to be? So my what if has to do with a household of whites and blacks, many of whom wind up dead, but it turns out they've been poisoned with datura, with angel trumpet, that poisonous plant we talked about. And this is the setup that I wrote for that. This is Mannequin Plantation in Goochland County, Virginia, October 3, 1861. Colonel John Burton rode into the slanting sun. Powdered red clay dust filmed his gray wool uniform and tanned face. He wore his slouch hat pulled low, shading his eyes. His horse knew the way and pursued it at a steady walk. When he came to a narrow drive lined with ancient cedars that branched off the main road, he pulled up, wet his lips from his canteen, and looked down the drive into the deep, fragrant cedar shade. Burton was 30 years old, brown-haired and bearded, of medium height and build. His colonel's insignia, as well as some things less tangible, the way he carried himself, the way he sat his horse, showed his aristocrat's blood. It was the invisible properties of blood, passed down from father to son, that made Burton heir to this plantation home, its 1,000 acres, its 50 slaves. Burton's chestnut gelding pawed the dirt, scenting home. Burton tightened his thigh muscles, urging the horse onto the drive. They covered its mile length at an easy pace. Now and then, a break in the line of cedars afforded a glimpse of brown plowed earth and stubbled fields, then, farther, of dark green forests. The field hands would be plowing and ashing the acres from which the wheat had been cut, plowing and sowing winter wheat on acres where corn had been harvested, planting potatoes, felling oak, walnut, sycamore, and pine. At last the drive met the brick walkway and curved away on either side. Burton held the reins in a gloved hand and stared at the two-story white frame house, classically symmetrical with chimneys at each end and paired sets of windows spreading out from an unpretentious one-story portico. All was quiet inside the house and around it. Where was the servant who would meet a guest and see to his horse? He looked around, frowning. At length he dismounted and walked forward, holding the chestnut's reins. Now he could see a figure that had been hidden in a shadow, a brown-skinned girl sitting on an overturned box near the door. Her mouth hung open. She was grabbing at something in front of her face, and she took no notice of him. Burton dropped the reins and walked up the steps, staring at the girl. She did not look up or pause in her repeated gesture, first one hand, then the other, clutched at the empty air in front of her eyes. The sound of his boots on the wooden porch seemed to rouse her. Her hands stopped their clutching motion, and she raised her eyes toward his looming form. Her eyes were deep black, their color swallowed up in darkness. Burton took a step backward. As he continued to stare, he saw her gaze shift away from him, the clutching gesture resume. Well, he walks through the house and sees no one. The table is laid. He walks over to the window and sees where the diamonds have etched the names and dates of people's engagements. Then he walks to the foot of the staircase, and it says, he put his booted foot on the bottom step, hesitated just a moment, and mounted the stairs. Then he noticed the smell. Long before Manassas, he had known, as every countryman knows, who has seen a hog butchered or carved up a deer, the smell of blood.
Goodness.
Yeah. Sorry.
You're such a gentle person in real life.
It's a murder mystery.
You said that other people were valuable to you, but that you were not in a writer's group at the time. I know you are in a writer's group now and have actually been quite active in helping Richmond writers by being one of the founding members of the James River Writers. Tell us a little bit about your decision to get involved in or to help start that group.
Well, I was invited to come on the board because I had met David Robbins at a panel that we were both on, and he remembered me and asked me to join, and I did, and it was very fun and interesting and challenging, and I was the chair of the first writer's conference with great help from my friend Ann Westrick, who is now, administrative director. I can't remember what her title is, but running James River Writers. It's a wonderful group. The conferences are very exciting, and they're doing all sorts of other things now, monthly meetings, social meetings, panels, all year round. So I would strongly urge anybody in Richmond or the area who's interested in becoming a writer to get involved with James River Writers.
Well, and you mentioned a name very familiar to our listeners, Dave Robbins, who's also been a guest with us here on The Writer's Voice. I wanted to ask a little bit more about Narcissa Powers. I guess really my impression is that Narcissa is, with Judah, the main character. Would you say that, or would you say that Narcissa and Judah and Britt are a triumvirate of main characters?
I had to bring Britt in because I needed the male point of view, and I wanted an outsider point of view, somebody who didn't really have a horse in the race. And he brought in several different perspectives from that angle. I found it very hard to write male characters. I was rather surprised by that. I've always complained about male writers who didn't do a good job with women characters, but now I understand much better. But yes, I think the two main points of view are definitely Narcissa and Judah Daniel. Narcissa's name, Narcissa Powers, is a family name in my family because I wanted people not to read my books and say, hey, you named so-and-so after my relative, so I just made them my relatives. Of course, the famous Narcissa in fiction right now is, in the Harry Potter series, Malfoy's mother is named Narcissa.
Oh, I had forgotten that. That's right.
But as far as being a narcissist, I don't think that's particularly true of her. But the reason she's interesting to me is that she is somebody who has a lot to learn about life and the world, can't go everywhere, but as a widow she can go more places than an unmarried woman could have gone. But one major reason that I had to have the different points of view is none of my characters could go everywhere. So in order to tell the whole story and show all the different angles, I had to have a white man, a free black woman, and a white woman.
I read that you originally started by writing in the first person as Narcissa Powers.
Yes, and that's when I realized that she couldn't go anywhere. So I had to bring in some more people.
You also mentioned earlier that after you finished the first draft, you had to go back and work some more. I'm interested in the process and how many times maybe you wrote these books.
Oh, well, I would start with outlining in just a spiral-bound notebook and re-outline many, many times during the writing. And even when I would be writing, as opposed to outlining, I would change things drastically and then change them back and then change them to the way they originally were and then change them back again and then change them back to the way they originally were. And I think I usually decided that the way they originally were was the better way. A lot of rewriting. I really think that there is no such thing as writing. It's all rewriting. You have to get the words on the page, but only after you get the words on the page is when the important work starts.
But it's a mystery. One assumes you have to know what's in the last chapter before you start the first chapter.
Yes, hence the importance of outlining, especially with three points of view. That's when the three points of view became very difficult because they had to learn certain things at certain times that would complement each other but not give things away, and then they would have to come together and share information, and then they would have to go out and sleuth some more. So having three points of view was tough for plotting purposes.
But it all makes sense if you are the reader, and I compliment
you.
Well,
thank you.
On that.
I hope that's true.
There are four books in the series. You have written other things. What are you working on now? I guess you just recently published a short story?
Yes, I had a plot idea for the fifth book, which I didn't get a contract for. And I was so intrigued by it that I kept playing with it and trying to think of the way, because it's a very difficult plot to pull off. And finally, when I pared it down to about 20 pages and pared out the main characters from the novels and came up with just different characters, because I really could only use the characters that were very necessary for this plot. But I still kind of play with the idea of doing it as a novel, even though to people who read the short story, they wouldn't be surprised by who did it, but I think there may be more that I want to say about that story.
So you may work on that.
I may work on a longer version.
I noticed in reading about what's been going on in your life, too, that your mystery short story, Castle Thunder, has just been made available on Kindle. Now, first, mystery short story?
Well, that's the one I'm talking about that started off as a novel, but then just got paired back to a short story.
So those of us with Kindles can read the short story in anticipation of possibly someday reading the mystery, the longer treatment?
Possibly. You'll have to tell me if it makes you want to. But I do like the fact that I'm making a little money on Kindle and have now bought my own Kindle and enjoy it a lot. So I'm all in favor of Kindles. Although if asked, I will send somebody a hard copy of it.
Okay. Well, Anne, thank you very much for joining us here on The Writer's Voice. We've enjoyed getting to know you and a little bit more about your writing. We will look forward to hearing Angel Trumpet and Civil Blood here on The Virginia Voice. I'm Patty Campbell, and you're listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.